So I'd like to say something today about Christianity and change, because obviously if we're in an ecological crisis, there are some changes that have to take place, and if we're Christian people, then somehow or another we have to make some connection, I take it, between Christianity and change, and so I thought that might be a worthwhile topic to look at. And on Thursday, I put up there for this hour, the Bible, : Word of God, / Words of Men. I think that has a lot to do with some of us who happen to be Lutherans and who know something about the tremendous crisis that's going on in Lutheran Church Missouri Synod at the present time over certain statements that are being made about the Bible, and massive disruption of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod Seminary in St. Louis over this question about the Bible, Word of God, and or words of men. But I hope that that also has something to do with the ecological crisis thing, because again, if we are Christian people who somehow or another get our signals from the Bible, then it makes a whale of a lot of difference whether or not we look at the Bible as words of men in addition to it being word of God, and if so, how we relate those. So on Thursday, I thought that might be a topic that might tie into this thing, and on Saturday, I put down the global mission of the church, : why not just let people be? In my mind, that ties in too, because as soon as we talk about ecological crisis, we talk about the disastrous way in which the United States and the Western world, which is where most Christians are, the way that Western world, or if you want, that's a bad designation, but there's some ways in which you can say it, I think the Christian world is wrecking the place and exploiting people and raping the earth and slaughtering people. How does that tie in with the commission of Christ, go and baptize and teach, if it's the Christians, specifically in the world, that are wrecking the place? What right do we have, or how can we think of going and propagating the faith that is, in fact, inciting us to the wrecking of the earth? So there is all kinds of question at the present time about whether or not we ought to let people be and let well enough alone and to quit exporting Christianity. So that's, I thought we'd put that on Saturday. I think that has something to do with ecological crisis too. So what I'm trying to do Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday is to just add a little footnote to the ecological crisis conversation. And today the topic is Christianity and change. Pardon me? Yeah. The global mission. Why not let people be? Okay, the topic today is Christianity and change, and I have a little thing to say, a little thesis to spell out. We have until noon, and I'll try to do that in like a half hour to 40 minutes or something, no more than that, and we'll have time to converse. If while I'm going you want to raise something or ask questions of clarification, you can surely do that, but I will leave time for discussion afterwards. My thesis can be stated very simply, and I'll say that and then try to spell it out. The thesis is that Christianity has to do with change. It does not have to do with the changeless.
I shall now repeat the thesis.
Christianity has to do with change. It does not have to do with the changeless. Okay, this morning in the ecological crisis session, there were all kinds of phrases floating around. We alter lifestyle, the alteration of lifestyle, the redistribution of wealth, the elasticity of demand, the ecological crisis, the projection of need, the shortage of resources, predictions about the future. Every one of those phrases is a time phrase. Every one of those phrases has to do with change. Change is what it's all about. Now, it seems to me that it is utter and absolute disaster for the Church of Jesus Christ if at any time, but particularly at this time, if explicitly or implicitly we give the notion that Christianity has to do with the changeless. It does not have to do with change. I'm saying Christianity has to do with change. It does not have to do with the changeless. Okay, now, we have to face the fact, however, that Christianity has been said to do with the changeless. It has been talked about as having to do with not change but the changeless. In a massive way, it has been talked about in that manner. Now, you can always run through the hymn book and pick out goodies to ridicule. That's a favorite sport of people like myself. And no matter what your opinion is on anything, you can always find some hymn to ridicule, because obviously there's a great diversity in the church's hymnody. But I'm inclined to think that there is a rather consistent pattern in the life of the church which has hooked up Christianity with that which is changeless. For instance, in heavenly love abiding, no change my heart shall fear, and safe is such confiding, for nothing changes there. Now that is as flat out as anything could possibly be. And the church has sung that for years and years, and I rather suspect that there are lots and lots and lots of people for whom that really says it just right. That's what it's all about. In heavenly love abiding, no change my heart shall fear. Safe is such confiding, for nothing changes here. Or, abide with me, fast falls the eventide, etc. O thou who changest not, abide with me. In this world of change and decay, there is something that changes not. God. And you come to the church to plug in to that changeless thing or phenomenon or experience or something which is available in the church which is not available elsewhere. Now, I think that there is something kind of intrinsic about the connection between religion and changelessness. I think that can be spelled out in lots of different ways, and I'm going to be getting way out of my own area of competence here, and you're going to have to correct me, some of you people who know a whale of a lot more about what I'm talking about than I do. But I think that a case can be made from all kinds of different directions about an intrinsic connection between religion and changelessness. For instance, And I, you know, I don't know very much about this, but it seems to me that when men change from a nomadic to an agricultural kind of life, and they start raising grain that is storable, then it is no longer necessary for each head of each family unit to go out and shoot a deer or something and fix it for his family. It is possible for people to raise grain and to store that grain, and that makes it possible for people to do other things than gathering food. And civilization begins to be possible because it is possible for people to do other things than strictly agriculture. One of the things that becomes possible is political life. It's possible for people to be full-time politicians and kings and government people because they don't have to be out on the farm. They can be eating the grain that's raised by the farmers. It's also possible to have an army, a full-time, paid professional army, because those people don't have to raise grain either. They can eat the grain raised by the farmers. It's also possible to have religious functionaries. It's possible to have full-time, paid, professional priests. And so at the very beginning of civilization and city building, you have a kind of a military, industrial, religious complex building up where politician and soldier and priest are all in cahoots with one another. They all have a stake in the status quo because if there's some kind of disturbance, if there's some kind of revolution, if the natives get restless, then they can no longer dip their hand into the granary and provide themselves with the food that's necessary to carry on their functions. So the priest becomes one who keeps the natives restful and helps to prevent them from getting restless. Religion, I think, as it begins, has a stake in the status quo. It has some kind of intrinsic connection with changelessness. That's one way one can come at it. I think that it's also possible to do it in terms of the connection between religion and nature. It's a very new datum, specifically in Western history, to think of nature in terms of time and movement and process. The kind of conversation that's going on this morning about resources being used up and time projections and all, that's a very, very new datum, specifically on Western soil. And one only gets that if one first learns to arrange the universe temporally rather than spatially. Originally it was not like that because people had a much shorter range look at things. And if you simply look at nature and you see the sun coming up and going down, and tomorrow it comes up and it goes down and it comes up and goes down, and that happens through your entire life. And you see a tree that grows and it dies, and another one grows and dies, and you see the cycle of life going around and around and around, or you see the Nile overflowing and receding and overflowing, depositing its silt and coming back again, overflowing again seasonally. And that never stops. It stops now when we build the Aswan Dam. But as nature is, that's cyclical. It goes around and around. Spring, we know that winter's going to come, it may not. But we can only now say it may not. There was a time when that was not possible to say it may not. We knew that was winter was going to follow fall and spring was going to follow winter. The monsoon comes, The dry season comes, the monsoon comes, the dry season comes. There's a cyclical character to nature, and that means that change happens, but change is seasonal, change is cyclical, and that means that there really is no such thing as change, because it always comes back to the place where it started. Mircea Eliade talks about the myth of the eternal return. There is something intrinsic about changelessness and religion, and so all of the connection of religion with nature, with fertility cults, with seasonal celebrations, all have to do with the essential changelessness of reality. So one can do it, I think, in terms of the beginning of city building and civilization. One can do it in terms of the connection of religion with nature. One can do it also in relation to the connection between religion and philosophy. There have been all kinds, and here we're getting into Christianity, there have been all kinds of possibilities philosophically for Christianity, but the fact of the matter is that the great span of the church's life has been one of an intimate connection between Christianity and specifically Greek philosophy, and not Greek philosophy in general, but Greek philosophy specifically in relation to Plato and Aristotle. Plato had lots of things to say, obviously, but one thing that he said, and which in some way is the core of his thought, is that eternity is timelessness. We live in time. We are temporal creatures. That's unfortunate. We live in the unreal world. What we see is just the shadow of that which is real. The real is timeless. God is timeless. Everything that has to do with time is unreal, is separated from God. God is, by definition, timeless for Plato. O thou who changest not, abide with me. In heavenly love abiding, no change my heart shall fear, and safe in such confiding, for nothing changes there. Pure, unadulterated Platonism. Aristotle comes along, very different from Plato in many ways, more of a biologist than a mathematician, all kinds of differences. Aristotle does not talk in terms of time and eternity so much as he talks in terms of potentiality and actuality. And in a way, there's a lot of movement and drive in Aristotle's thought. Aristotle says that everything in this universe is moving. The acorn is moving to become an oak tree. The child is moving to become an adult. Everything is in process, except one place and one thing, and that one place, that one thing we call God. God is, for Aristotle, pure act. But that doesn't mean pure action or pure activity. For Aristotle, it means pure actuality. That is, there is no potentiality in God. God is purely actualized, therefore he is the prime mover unmoved. And everything in this universe is attracted to, moving toward God, but the one immovable, changeless place in the universe is God. Now, throughout the history of Christian thought, especially until the time of the Reformation, but even after that, and even to the present time, there is no philosophical device that has been as closely plugged into the Christian faith as has the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle. And so Christianity has been talked about in terms of God as the changeless one. And if God is the changeless one, then everything that has to do with God, Bible, prayer, Christian life, outlook on the world. Everything that has to do with God, everything that has to do with Christianity, is by definition also essentially that which has to do with the changeless. Now, when you read the Bible, unless you've been royally screwed up by Plato and Aristotle, it isn't like that. And you read Amos and Jeremiah and Micah and John the Baptist and Jesus and Paul, and those guys are not promoters of the status quo. They are change agents like crazy. The categories in which the Bible is set are not the categories of nature and supernature. The categories are old and new, beginning and end, alpha and omega, promise and fulfillment. They're time categories. They're history categories. When the people of the scripture want to talk about God, they don't talk about fertility cults. Granted, there's that stuff in there, but that's not the red thread of the scripture. They don't talk about fertility cults. They don't look at a tree or the sun and the moon and the stars and say, wow, God must be something like that. But they remember events in history that are signals of God's involvement in this world and in their lives. And so all throughout the Old Testament, God is talked about not as the prime mover unmoved or the one who dwells in eternity, which is changeless, but he is the God who brought us out of Egypt, who did something in time. And the God of the New Testament is the God who raised Jesus from the dead. And that's how Pontius Pilate gets into the creed. Because, as Dorothy Sayers says, there has been incarnate gods aplenty and slain and resurrected gods, not a few, but he is the only God who has a date in history. The faith of the people of God in the scriptures is not tied to timelessness, but it's tied to time. It's not tied to changelessness, but it's tied change. The scripture screams out, the name of the game is change, and the name of the change agent is Jesus Christ. Now, the thesis is that Christianity has to do not with changeless, but with change, and that although the church has talked for 20 centuries and still talks about in heavenly love abiding, no change my heart shall fear, the gospel of Jesus Christ, born when Quirinius was governor of Syria, suffered under Pontius Pilate, the fulfillment of the promise to those people whom God brought out of Egypt, that gospel which the church has, in spite of itself, proclaimed, has been rolling down through history in essentially, not exclusively, the Western world, and has had an explosive effect not only on man's individual gut, but on a whole way of viewing reality. Henri Bergson talks about man's inevitable tendency to spatialize the universe. What the gospel has done, in spite of the church's screwing up the message, which somehow or another has gotten out anyway, what the gospel has done is to lead people into temporalizing rather than spatializing the universe. And that means time, and that means history, and that means change. Now, I give you a quotation from Paul Tillich, and I have lots of problems with Tillich. I find myself much more on the Bardian side of things and on the Tolkien side of things, but once in a while he came through with something very, very nice. And quite a long time ago, he wrote a little essay entitled Historical and Non-Historical Interpretations of History. It's in a book, The Protestant Era. It's a beautiful little essay. And Tillich says that it's possible to interpret history out of the context of nature. That is, you can look at nature and say, wow, history must be something like that. Oswald Spengler, The Decline of the West, is essentially a cyclical view of history. Toynbee even has a kind of a cyclical thing, although it's a little bit of a spiral. You can look at nature and you can say history must be like that. That's interpreting history out of nature. Tillich says that's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is to interpret history out of history. That is, by looking at events and saying history has to do with things that have happened and will happen. Tillich says that the difference, he says, granted there is no space without time and no time without space, etc., etc., etc. All right, nevertheless, the difference in fundamental structure is very evident between reading history out of nature and reading history out of history. Religion, as well as philosophy, must choose between these two possibilities, which ultimately are exclusive, and this choice is the decision against or for Christianity. Now, I happen to buy that, and that's one reason that, for me at least, religion is a dirty word. Religion is a very inappropriate word to get at the guts of the Christian faith. Because religion is a word that has to do with spatializing the universe. It has to do with nature and supernature. It has to do with the myth of the eternal return. The Christian faith has to do with involvement in and embracing of historical events. I'm going to give you another quotation, which I happen to buy, from a fellow by the name of Arend van Leeuwen, a Dutch theologian. And this gets us into, although that's really the topic for Saturday, but it gets us into the whole business of the global mission of the church and the relation of the West, the quote, granted, the quotes qualify it, the Christian West, to the rest of the world. This is a book entitled Christianity in World History. And van Leeuwen says this, what is happening now is that the people who have no history, that is, who think spatially rather than historically, are being drawn into the history of which the center is Jesus Christ, and that is the only history. In other words, that which has been static, or at least cyclical, in which the only movement was round and round, life and death, rise and fall, that is being drawn into a movement which is linear and dynamic, which is moving irreversibly and can never be back where it was before. The ferment of change which arises from the impact upon ancient cultures of the gospel, or at least of that kind of life which has its origin within Christianity, is the force which is giving an irreversible direction to that which was static or merely cyclical. When I say the impact of the gospel or of that kind of life which has its origins within Christendom, I include technology, Western political ideas, communism, which Brunner calls the bastard offspring of Christian eschatology and humanistic anthropology, all those things which have come into the Eastern world from the West and have their roots in the Christian tradition. Now, that's essentially the thesis. Let me try to illustrate that in a few areas. I think that one can kind of say that the world lived for years with an essentially static or
spatial understanding of reality. At the time of the Renaissance, the Reformation, which are hand-in-glove movements and not really contradictory movements, that change thing begins to take off. And that's a result of the impregnation of the Western tradition with the gospel, which has to do with a God involved in time and not separated from time. That thing begins to explode. That has to do with the transition from a geocentric to a heliocentric universe and all kinds of things. At the time of the Renaissance Reformation, that begins to take off. At the present time, change is so central to our entire way of life. It is not just that things are changing. People say, well, things have always changed. It's not just that things are changing. It's not even that things, that the rate of change is accelerating. It's not even that. It's that change has entered the very core of our understanding of reality, and that's a brand new thing in the history of the world. It's not even that. It's that change has entered the very core of our understanding of reality, and that's a brand new thing in the history of the world. And I'm saying that it is a result of the impregnation of essentially Western society by the gospel of Jesus Christ. Now, that has hit different areas at different times. Let me take one example with a few paragraphs, and I'll mention a few others, and then I'll quit. Let me take lexicography, because that's an illustration of where change has entered our thinking in very, very recent times. How do you define a word? If someone asked you to write a dictionary, and not just do a scissors and paste job from other dictionaries, but start from scratch to write a dictionary, how would you go about it? There are two basic ways that you could do it. One way would be the way of etymology. That is, you say, what is the meaning of a word? A word means what its root means. So you find that this word comes from this Latin root, and that Latin word means such and so, therefore that's what this word means. That's the way of etymology. And that is the basic way in which words have been defined. That's the basic way in which dictionaries have been written up until very, very recently. The other way is to say that you find the meaning of a word by usage, by context. Its etymology may be interesting, but a word has no permanent meaning. A word has no right meaning. A word only has a meaning that a given group of people decide to assign to it. And that's it. The meaning of words changes. Now, as fantastic as it seems, that little simple thing took a long, long time to develop, and it's very, very recently that dictionary writers have been willing to embrace the contextual rather than the etymological principle. Second edition of Webster came out in 1937. It's based essentially on etymology. Obviously, there's something about usage, but essentially, Webster 2 says the meaning of a word is get attable by looking at its root. Second edition of Webster came out in, 1951? Third edition, pardon me, 1951. The third edition of Webster is based on the contextual principle. Of course, it has something to do with etymology. But it says, when you work with etymology, you say, what's that Greek root? And you go back to the Greek root. How do you know what that root means? That doesn't have a permanent meaning. Where do you want to pick it up? What century in the Greek tradition you want to pick that up? Where in the Greek-speaking world you want to pick up that root? The only way you can find out what that meaning, that root meaning is by context. So the third edition of Webster comes out based on the contextual principle. The New York Times forbid its editors to use the third edition of Webster when it came out. They said you're going to ruin the English language. Anything can mean anything. Everything is moving. Everything is flowing. You can't any longer say this is what a word means, period. And they said, the third edition is a disaster. Saturday Review of Literature came out with similar reviews. That's as late as 1951. It's a disaster. You can't handle language that way, they said. Our librarian at Luther Seminary, I asked about the third edition. She says, well, we'll buy it, but that's going to go back in the stacks. We're not going to put that thing out, for people to use, because it's going to wreck the language. Okay, in these few years, the contextual principle in lexicography has simply been adopted because that's simply the way things are. Words obviously don't have permanent meaning. And American Heritage Dictionary came out a couple of years ago, and you may have that dictionary. It's now in paperback, or you may have read reviews of it. What they did is to get together a committee of 100 people, and they voted. So what does the word mean? 37 people vote this. 22 people mean this. 12 people mean this. And that's the way it is. That is the way it is. You may like a word to have a permanent meaning, but it doesn't. The meaning of words change, and etymology is interesting, but context, usage, change, is the way things are. Now that has a great deal to do with the Christian faith. There's a great deal to do with the gospel penetrating our consciousness, our way of thinking. I'm going to mention a couple of other areas briefly. I think, Rich, we haven't talked about this. I don't know, you may think I'm absolutely out of my mind. I would like to try to make a case for saying that there is something traceable from, let's say, I don't even know if these words make sense, from photographic to kinetic art. Mobiles happen, at a time in history. That Jackson Pollock could not have stood on a ladder and dripped paint in the 13th century, I think. He couldn't have done that. Because the consciousness of movement and time and change had not penetrated the mind of Western man that deeply. Leo, I'm not a biologist, for goodness sakes. I'm saying these things with my bare face hanging out because there are people here who can correct me. But there is, for instance, a volume by Theodosius Dobzhansky of Harvard. He's a biologist. The title of the book is The Biology of Ultimate Concern. It is in a series of books edited by Ruth Nanda Anshin entitled Perspectives in Humanism. And Ruth Nanda Anshin says in the preface to the series, and in the preface to Dobzhansky's book, she says, Perspectives in Humanism is designed to affirm that the world, the universe, and men are remarkably stable, eternally unchanging. That's why she put out the series of books, to get that message across. It is that heritage of timeless and immutable values on which we can fix our gaze whenever the language of change and decline, you notice change and decline are always connected in this thing. Change equals decline. Change and decline, which history speaks, that's Ruth Nanda Anshin. History speaks change equals decline, which history speaks seems to become too overwhelming for the human heart. Right? If we look at history, that means change, that means decline, it's too overwhelming. We fix our gaze on the eternal, unchangeable values, and so on. That's the preface to this book by Theodosius Dobzhansky. Dobzhansky says, I mean, Anshin, Ruth Nanda Anshin is very, obviously a very busy person. She doesn't read her manuscripts that she published. Dobzhansky says, in any case, the world is not fixed. It is not finished. It is not unchangeable. Everything in it is engaged in evolutionary flow and development. In particular, it is not true that human nature does not change.
Well, I was going to tell you that Dobzhansky would not agree with that.
Oh, really? Terrific. He would not agree with Ruth Nanda Anshin. Right, okay. This nature is not status but process. The potentialities of man's development are far from exhausted, either biologically or culturally.
I don't know if we have a physicist here, but we certainly have people who know well of a lot.
Where? That's Paul Gravrock.
Oh, that's great.
A man of the cloth.
Yeah, could be.
Well, I'm a long ways away, and I have a long glasses on.
All right. Ian Barbour. Ian Barbour, Carleton College, is a physicist. I think he's an excellent writer in the whole religion science business. Here's a statement from Barbour. Classically, matter. You know, what is the word? What is art? What is life? What is matter? Classically, matter was thought to consist of inert particles that could be rearranged in space without themselves undergoing any change. That's the old Tinker Toy method of teaching physics, right? In that case, a particle does not require any temporal duration in order to be. In the new physics, time is constitutive of the being of atoms. A wave or a musical note requires time in order to exist. A note is nothing at an instant. Matter seems more like a sequence of events than a collection of substances.
I don't know what that means. But that really blows my mind, huh? Matter is not a sequence of events. It is not a collection of substances. It is a sequence of events. That is a time. That is a history. That is a process. That is a change way of understanding reality. Now, I don't know anything about economics either, but I think you can move from Adam Smith, the invisible hand of God, the law of supply and demand, to Keynes and the tinkering, the fine-tuning of the economy. I think there is absolutely no phase, no facet, no aspect of contemporary life as viewed in the West which is understandable apart from the category of change. It's not just that things are changing. It's not even just that the rate of acceleration of change is increasing. It's that change has entered the very warp and weft of our understanding of reality. My thesis is that in no small part, that is a result of the proclamation and the penetration of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And that the one super disastrous thing that the church can do now is to say, everything is changing, but we are that one place in the universe that has changelessness for sale. Come to us, and we'll give you some changelessness. That's the one super disastrous thing that the church can say. Because it is precisely the gospel proclaimed by the church which has brought this thing about, and which has, in my opinion, better resources for handling and directing change than are available any other place on this earth. Well, that's kind of the thing. I better stop. What would you like to say?
I think that William is maybe here for somebody to say to quote a Bible passage.
Be my guest.
Like Christ saying yesterday, today, and forever. And of course, being involved in the Missouri Synod's evangelism program, the thing that we have been handed to work on is the logo that has been operating with.
Oh, no.
That is the basis.
Now, I mean, I heard that years ago, but you mean like today?
Yeah.
Next year, the future, yes. A changeless Christ for a changing world.
That's 1673. You're in it, too.
So
I mean...
My ALC picks a different angle.
I have seen, you know, T73 literature. I have not seen that phrase connected with T73.
Well, our material is also changing.
See, I really do think that slogan, a changeless Christ for a changing world, is total and complete disaster and rejection of the gospel of Jesus Christ. I mean, you know, if you say Jesus Christ the same yesterday, today, and forever, okay, what you have to do is to start talking in terms of like faithfulness. To say that change is an appropriate category for talking about God and changelessness is inappropriate is not to say that God is arbitrary, that God is chaotic, that Allah wills, or something like that. But you begin to talk in terms like faithfulness to his covenant promise, faithfulness to his people. You can begin to talk in terms of the consistency of his attachment to his goal. You can start to talk about the fact that God will accomplish that which he sets out to do, but those are all categories which guard against anarchy in God and still allow us to embrace God as the Lord of history and the Lord of time and movement and process and change.
Doesn't change.
I am so scared to death of that whole changelessness business that I really don't want to use that word changeless at all about God. I would want to use words like faithfulness. God continues to love his people. God will do what he... You know, Harvey Cox at the end of The Secular City takes that I am that I am and translates, I shall do what I shall do. That's beautiful. Pardon me? No. Only that one translation. But that thing, that's really a nice translation. What does holy mean? What does love mean? What does almighty mean? I would even take off after the classic attributes of God. I would say that to begin with the attributes, God is almighty, all-powerful, all-knowing, and all of this. You can make up that kind of God, you know, in 3 minutes with a piece of paper and a pencil. All you have to do is say, God is totally different from me. I'm a little guy. He's a big guy. I've got a peanut brain. He must know everything. I can only do so many things. He must be able to do everything. The classic attributes of God are think upable by anyone on the street corner, totally apart from the biblical story of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who brought his people out of Egypt and who raised Jesus Christ from the dead. So I would say, you know, if one wants to use those terms like God is almighty, and when we use them, we get screwed up in all kinds of messes, with if God knew that, so-and-so, then if he's all-powerful. There's all kinds of phony problems that come in the back door. But if we want to use those words, I think we have to use them like X, Y, and Z, way down the road. We have to begin with the Jesus who is Lord of history, and understand those terms in the light of that, not begin with those kinds of definitions. Holiness is a movement word. Holiness is a direction word. To be holy is to be whole. There is a connection between those words in the development of the English language. To be holy is to be whole, that is to be wholly, totally committed, to be moving in a direction. To be holy is to be dedicated, commitment. To be unholy is to move contrary to God's movement in the world. That's a direction term. You can go through, you mentioned Bible verses, If you take, lo, I am with you, even to the end of the ion is the Greek word. King James Version translates to the end of the world. That's a spatial term. But time begins to penetrate even the minds of the translators, and RSV says even to the end of the age. And you move to a time word. You look that up in the Greek lexicon that says, what does ion mean? That means either world or age, that depends on what you think God is about. Or take, for instance, Jesus' word to Nicodemus, you must be born. What does he say? The word is anothen in Greek, and Jesus says you must be born again. If you look in the footnote of your Revised Standard Version, it says you can also translate, does anybody happen to know? From above. You look that up in the Greek lexicon, anothen means again or from above. If you think that God is up there in the timeless realm, then you translate, you must be born from above. But if you think that the whole thing has to do with time and movement and change, then you translate, you must be born again. Or, Carol brought up the other day Hebrews 11,
about faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Which one of those lines do you grab onto? If he's the evidence of things not seen, that is, the things we can see, that we can taste, that we can touch, that move, that doesn't have anything to do with God. God is in the other realm of the unseen. But if you think time and movement and change and process, then you take the first line, that faith is the evidence of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. That is, they're not seen not because they're in another world, they're not seen because they haven't happened yet. And the whole Christian faith and life and way of reading the world has to do with what God is doing here, not with God's being. You take the book on the Bible, Wright and Fuller, the title of that book is The Book of the Acts of God. That's a radically different way of reading the Bible from reading it as the book of the being of God. Being follows act, not the other way around.
Would you say then the way in which God is changing is that he is at work at what he has, at what he is after for the salvation?
And this whole cosmos. I think God has a fantastic stake in the ecology of this planet. For goodness sakes, it belongs to him. So I think that we always have to understand man in the context of God's creation and not the other way around. What the Bible is about is God and his creation, of which we are a part. It does not have to do with God and men who then may or may not choose to relate to his world. It's a cosmic sweep that we get in the Bible. So I always get a little nervous even about the salvation of man. It's the saving, it's the redemption of his creation that he's concerned about. I'm a part of that, and I'm a responsible part of that, and he's even willing to use me in getting his job done, which is pretty great. Yeah. I admit that that's, there are lots of problems with that. Yeah, I don't, that, why not? Why not? Huh? I mean, again, a matter of how you understand right and wrong. Before time takes over, then right and wrong are simple. They're absolute. They're not relative to. They're not contingent upon anything, right? But when time and history and movement take over, then everything is relative to, contingent upon what situation you're in. And right and wrong no longer become timeless realities, but right and wrong become words used in a given time and a given place that have to do with the appropriateness of a given behavior, depending on which direction that behavior helps to move things. And so Christians ought to say, this is right because it contributes to what God is doing with his world. It's wrong because it contradicts what God is doing in his world. So there is no non-contextual, non-situational way of talking about right and wrong if one moves with the living Lord who is at work redeeming his world.
I
thinking of this as part of a reverse type of thing, and going along with your idea that God changes. This doesn't necessarily, he is right and omnipotent and all these things, even as he changes. And then thinking of the reverse, and he made men in his own image. And certainly we know that we change. Mm-hmm. And so if we change and we are in his image, then thinking back reversely, then he also would be able to change.
Some will say we are changing because we lost that image. I can't find it changing God, because it's an opposite. Denying him his perfection. I don't know.
What does perfection mean again? You see, that thing cuts through every facet of the faith line. So what is the perfection, pardon me?
Well, if he's changing, that means he wasn't perfect.
No. What does perfection mean? Perfection can be thought about in two different ways. Perfection, at least. Perfection can mean lack of moral mess. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Perfection can mean doing all the right things and avoiding all the wrong things. Or perfection can mean, teleologically or historically, bringing something to perfection. Huh? It can mean a movement word. And when God says, when Jesus says, you must be perfect as your Heavenly Father is perfect, that's not a moralistic exhortation. But what it says is, become now what you are. Allow God to bring to completion, to fulfillment, to perfection, that which he made you to be. Perfection is a movement word. It is precisely a time process movement word. And God is perfect because he is complete and whole and holy in the direction in which he is moving with his world toward the redemption of all things. Bring to completion, to fulfillment, to perfection is perfect. In the direction in which he is moving with his world toward the redemption of all things.
Well, you know, there's a paradox.